From the tavern, Billy pulled the wagon through the wide tracks made by horses' hooves and carriage wheels. The night was damp and cold, the light gray from the few sputtering gas lamps on iron posts. The snow hampered his progress, but he persevered, both hands curled around the iron handle of the wagon, his sack-covered burden lying perfectly still, a bag of feed by all appearances. He was slogging his way up Water Street, then he'd turn left on Orange Street and right on Mulberry to the second house on the left. He leaned forward, his gray felt hat pulled down to the tops of his eyes and over his large ears, his red hair bouncing with each tug. The streets were quiet at this hour. The houses lined the streets like strict Quakers, tall and dark and silent. Not even one welcoming orange glow from a black rectangular window. That was all right with Billy. Coming home past midnight with a sack of feed might raise a few questions, as if he'd stolen it from the livery. The only thing that kept Billy on the straight and narrow, which was wider for him than for some, was the thought of being clamped in those formidable stocks on the square in front of the county courthouse, where thieves and pickpockets, liars and frauds were stuck for days, while jesting onlookers made fun of them or threw tomatoes or eggs at them. Billy was afraid if that happened to him and he couldn't get out to avenge himself, he'd explode from his fiery temper. So he better watch out, he reasoned. He stopped the wagon by the front doorstep, dropped the handle, and pounded on the door with his fists. He waited, then pounded again, harder, looking over his shoulder. When the door creaked open, and his ma peered around the flickering yellow light from the candle flame, he was weak with relief.
Ma, I got a someone needs help.
Ach, du lieber, Gunther Felt!
As usual, Emma exclaimed in Dutch, set the candle down on the half-round wooden stand in the hallway just behind the heavy oak door, and lumbered down the stone steps to peer beneath the sack on the syke vaguely.
Mein Gott in Himmel, Billy! Now what have you got? A dead one, sure. An Indian? Oh, mein himmlischer Vater, ich bitte dich, hilf mir!
She was half-praying, half-crying, and her ever-present tears were already pooling in the soft folds beneath her eyes. She stroked the black hair and lifted the white face for further observation beneath the weak light of the gas street lamp.
Ein Meidler, ein schor Meidler. Oh, du je,
she wrung her hands, helpless in the rush of love and pity that consumed her.
Ma, you need to shut up now,
Billy said, not unkindly, but looking furtively over his shoulder, feeling keenly the possibility of being stuck tightly in those wooden stocks. Emma hoisted the girl's shoulders in her capable hands as Billy lifted her feet, grunting and exclaiming, Emma's breath coming in short puffs of steam in the gray, damp night. They hoisted the girl up the steps and into the candlelit hallway of the house. Carefully, they lowered her onto the multicolored rag rug. Emma straightened, her chest heaving beneath the yoke of her linen nightgown, one plump hand going to her breast as if to control the thumping of her heart. Emma whisked the sack away and rolled it into a ball, the dust from the feed wafting to the floor. She'd deal with that later. Billy held up the candle as Emma bent over the cold, inert form clad in deerskin. Her hands and feet were blue with cold. Blood had congealed and dried on her legs and hands. Billy was used to seeing injuries and starved folks, but he'd never seen a mess like this. The girl had been pretty, but the one side of her forehead was bulging with a huge blue-black bruise, oozing blood, the texture like sausage. Her eyes were hidden beneath the gross swelling. Her nose widened with the fluid that seeped from her injury. Her lips were chapped and bleeding, although much of the blood had dried black.
Ach, mein Herr Jesus, du komm.
Praying now, Emma felt the need of her Gott. Hardly ever did she feel a need, as she capably tackled ministering to the wounded just as she handled the rest of her life. Tenderly, she used her fingers to examine the wound and feel the cold limbs. They traveled over the young woman's body, searching for more injuries, broken bones, open wounds, clucking her tongue against the roof of her mouth with small sounds of sympathy. She finished her inspection, straightened, and began to bark orders. She lit two lamps in the kitchen. Then she stirred up the fire in the fireplace, added a hefty split log, and swung the black cast-iron kettle over the fresh flames. She moved rapidly with single-minded purpose to the sitting room, there lifting the heavy, warm coverlets. Then she was back in the kitchen, yellow with lamplight and the flickering flames beneath the pot of hot water. She spread the coverlets by the fire, then together they laid the girl on the soft warmth, so gently, so carefully. Billy put a down pillow beneath her head, and Emma drew up the heaviest coverlet to her chin. While the young woman slept, they poured warm water into a crockery bowl, shaved lye soap into it, then dabbed at her wounds. Billy silently took a homespun cloth, patted the scratches on her feet and legs with it, then applied the comfrey leaves from the warm water in another bowl. They worked together efficiently. They'd done this many times. When the wounds were sufficiently cleaned, they applied bandages. Emma administered the smelling salts, wafting them back and forth beneath the girl's nose. When she did not stir, Emma bent to lay an ear on her chest, nodded, and kept waving the evil-smelling salts. Shaking her head, she sat back.
"She gonna make it?"
Billy asked, his eyebrows raised.
"We should get her awake."
Grimly, she shook the thin shoulders, but her head wobbled back and forth on the pillow like a rag doll. This was beyond Emma's knowledge. She looked at Billy, and then at the door, as if she were trying to decide. Finally, she went to the tall cupboard by the opposite wall, took down a redware bowl of tea leaves, placed them in two cups, then dipped boiling water from the pot over the fire with a long-handled copper ladle. She poured some water in each cup, then handed one to Billy, who took it silently, wrapping his cold fingers around the heavy mug. He lifted the jar off the white cone of sugar, but Emma was too fast for him as she reached for the shears and clipped off a chunk of the expensive sugar. Her German frugality allowed her only a small snip for herself and a small one for Billy.
"Ma, that ain't enough for half a cup."
Ich glaub.
Billy had to be satisfied with the hot, semi-sweet tea, but was heartened when Emma set a cloth-covered bowl of biscuits and a small crock of jam beside him.
"So no, Billy, sage mir."
In fluent German, Billy told his story, relating his forays into the livery down by the tavern. Emma shook her head with consternation, blaming herself. She was far too easy on the boy. He should be at home in bed, not allowed to tramp about the streets, and certainly not near the tavern. But she knew about his stash of coins, knew too that he would aid her work in helping the poor. So how could it be so bad? That Billy had a head on his shoulders, so he did. He always had. The way his mother batted him around, it's a wonder he had a grain of sense. She looked down at the bruised, sleeping girl, then to Billy as if he could help her make a decision. She spread her third biscuit with Hula Shea and licked her fingers well, the sweet preserves sustaining her flagging spirits.
"Billy, was sagst?"
Billy shrugged as he looked down at the girl. The lamps burned steadily, a waste of expensive oil. Heaving herself to her feet, Emma lowered her face and pursed her round lips, giving a hefty whistling blow, extinguishing the lights.
"Let's try and get some rest, Billy. I'll check on her every hour, all right?"
The heat and the scalding hot tea were making him drowsy, so he nodded. Lifting the mug, he emptied it, placed it back on the table, and went upstairs to bed, unbuttoning his knee breeches as he went. It was the pain in her hands and feet that woke her. At first, she was aware of a ripping, tearing sensation, an awful thing she could not overcome. She moaned and turned her head, but an explosion of pain stopped her from doing anything. When she went to lift her hands to her head, giant pincers of pain gripped every finger. She tried to cry out, but found she had no voice. She held very still, as wave after wave of tingling pain coursed through her feet and up her legs. She shivered with cold. She could not remember anything and had no idea where she was. She was terrified, suspended between a place she could not remember and a void she could not grasp. She had no focus and no sight, only the clawing, ripping pain in her feet and hands. Slowly, she became aware of a persistent yellow light, a flickering through the blackness of her torment. She would open her eyes. It took all the strength she had, like lifting two huge stones. The pain in her head exploded into something so white and hot she could not tolerate it. She whispered, then moaned. She tried again to open her eyes. This time, before the pain overtook her, she saw the source of the flickering yellow light. A fire. She receded into unconsciousness, a blessed place of knowing, of feeling nothing at all until the painful sensation in her feet brought her unwillingly to the frightening knowledge that she was alive. All she knew was that she was somewhere between certainty and a vast area she knew nothing about, as if she were hurtling through a dark tunnel without end. With her entire being and the full strength of her will, she tried to focus, to find a foothold somewhere. Painful as it was, she lifted both eyelids, willing herself to find an object, something nearby that would help her make sense of this unbearable hurting in her feet and hands. A fireplace. A floor. Relief flowed through her veins. A floor. A wooden floor. She knew what that was. She knew the fire. A wetness ran down the sides of her face, and she knew why. She knew she was crying. She knew her name now. Hester Suk. When the rustling of skirts came near, she closed her eyes. When she heard the voice of someone saying words in German, she wondered if she was at home in the large stone house in Berks County with Hans and Annie. She wanted to see Lissy and Daniel and all the little children. She wanted to talk to Noah and Isaac the way she always had before they shunned her. Ach, ach, du liebe! The crooning continued, mixed with prayers and pleadings, all in the Pennsylvania Dutch Hester knew so well. She tried to tell this person about her pain. Her mouth opened, then closed and opened again, but she could not speak. She felt tender hands and willed them to her feet. A squawk of recognition sounded from the region of her worst pain now. Mieux grunt, difficile, sie fa failleux. Over and over she heard the exclamations about her feet being frozen. Then a slap, and the loud voice of the speaker berating herself. Dummkopf! What a dummkopf! Steps retreated hastily. A loud, urgent calling ensued, and then another person joined the Pennsylvania Dutch-speaking woman. Together, they placed her hands and feet in cold water. The pain worsened, and Hester cried out, then bore it uncomplaining. She knew about frozen toes and fingers, and so she allowed the work that Emma and Billy were doing. They gave her a shot of Enos's home-brewed whiskey, or tried to, but with Hester unable to swallow, they wiped away the dribble from her chin and what fell on the pillowcase and gave up. Her feet were still frozen, but tingling with a milder sensation. And when the morning light shone through the window panes, Hester was able to focus her eyes, despite her swollen eyelids. She saw a strange, round woman, wearing the English cap favored by the non-Amish. She saw a boy with riotous long hair the color of fire and copper. She saw a kitchen, a fireplace, a cupboard and plank table. She could read a few words of a stitched sampler on the wall. She remembered God, the hand that delivered her to this house. She thanked him softly. They brought warm water now, further decreasing the pain in her thawing limbs. She tried to let them know how she longed for water to drink. They brought a bowl with a rag and let her suck it greedily for the cool water. As she swallowed, she choked and coughed, grimacing from the pain in her head. But her thirst was so strong, she continued to work her throat muscles, finally receiving the life-giving water into her body. She told them her name in halting whispers. She learned theirs, Emma and Billy Ferry. These weren't Amish names, or Indian. Hester was confused. The woman spoke Dutch. Why was she not Amish? It took far too much effort to ask, so she closed her eyes and slept. She slept for days, waking only to drink water. It was early one afternoon when she finally awoke, her senses clear, her mind refreshed. She still lay on the oak floor in the kitchen by the fire. When Emma found her awake, she threw her hands in the air and yelled for Billy, who she'd forgotten had gone to school.
Guten Morgen! Guten Morgen!
Emma kept repeating. Then she proceeded to heat water, thinking she could finally get this poor, striking girl out of that Indian dress made of deerskin. She could just picture the lice and fleas that must be crawling all over Enos's mother's best sheep coverlet. When Hester tried to sit up, she couldn't make it the whole way, lying back down twice before she could stay erect. The pounding in her head increased each time, but she remained sitting upright, propped by the pillows Emma placed against the back of a chair. Emma washed her hair when Hester felt up to it, gently but thoroughly, and more than once. She bathed her like a small child, dressed her wounds, and put her in a heavy linen nightshirt that had been Enos's. She put his woolen socks on her feet and made a warm, honey-sweetened porridge with milk, feeding it to her by the spoonful and talking the entire time. When Billy came home from school about 2 hours late, she scolded like a hen whose eggs had been snatched from beneath her. But Billy didn't seem bothered by it, merely eating a slice of bread, tearing off the crust, and watching Hester, curiosity plastered all over his face.
"Hester, Hester Sook," Emma said. "Amish settlers in Berks County found her, an Indian baby at the spring close to the log house where they lived."
Billy's eyes lit up, recognition shining from their depths.
"You're like me!"
Hester smiled, a small widening of her mouth that caused her eyes and nose to feel stretched. It had been so long since they had been exercised in this way.
"Your second mom better than the first?"
Hester shook her head.
"Well, you ain't got a thing to worry about no more. Ma's the bestest there ever was."
Hester watched Billy's face, his natural kindness as beautiful as a wild rose or a sunset, a reflection of the good in humankind. But she wondered what Theodore Crane, the schoolmaster, would say if he heard that grammar. Chapter 7. Emma Ferry shook out the feed sacks that had covered her newest fugitive, wrinkled her nose at the dust that flew across the snow-covered bushes in her backyard, then laid them down on the stoop and ducked back inside. It was cold, too cold to hang out clothes, but the sun was bright, the air was fresh, and she wanted to wash those union suits, both hers and Billy's. When long underwear got to itching, it was time to wash it. She filled the gray wooden tubs, shaved lye soap into one, dumped in a pile of light-colored things, and began to stir with a well-worn wooden stick, swirling the thick, heavy undergarments around and around. The small room off the kitchen was thick with steam as she took up the wooden washboard and began to rub, her upper arms flapping in time to the furious scrubbing she gave the items she was washing. Why, she'd sat beside Rhoda Dienlinger down at the church house on Sunday and endured all that itching in silence until she declared there must be insects in unreachable areas of her outerwear as well as her underwear. She was in so much misery during the service she hardly heard a word the minister said, and all that week it seemed as if her soul needed food, which she couldn't find just by reading her Bible. It was the way John Evans spoke, so true, so pleading. It just filled her soul with grace. And now she'd have to go hungry all week where spiritual food was concerned, all on account of her insect-infected clothes. She wrung the cumbersome garments with hands turned red from the hot water, then wrapped up in a too small shawl, tied on the Visse Pütze Sock, threw a heavy scarf across her head, took up the basket of washing, and ventured briskly into the frigid morning. She shook out Billy's union suit and had just pegged it firmly to the line when a deep voice shouted her name. That dreaded voice was the very reason she didn't wash her long underwear more often. Turning calmly, she answered in what she hoped was a level voice, her mouth flat, her face expressionless.
Why, Walter Trout.
She didn't say it with a twinge of welcome or excitement, not even a smidgen of gladness. She meant to convey just a simple recognition, albeit grudgingly, as, "Oh, there you are, and I wish you weren't."
"Good day to ya, Emma. Wonderful morning, wonderful."
The beaming man on the opposite side of the fence could only be described as vast. His face was wide and florid, alive with color and good humor, his shoulders, back, and stomach twice the size of any other man. He wore no coat or hat. His pink head was circled with a ewe of gray hair, as if a squirrel had taken up permanent residence around his noggin. Emma was in no mood to take his sugary description of this frigid winter morning when she was just about to hang up her undergarment shift, which he could easily examine. So she turned her back, bent, and picked up the basket, and returned to her washing, slamming the door unnecessarily. Nosy, overfed man, if he'd stop eating all that tripe and liverwurst. Well, she was not hanging out her shift. She'd dry it inside. It dripped all over the clean floor. So she waited till he had himself back inside, then scuttled out the back door, her head lowered. She looked neither left or right as she brought the wooden clothespins down hard on the offending garment now hanging on the wash line. She had just reached down to retrieve a petticoat when a stentorian voice made her jump all over. She nearly dropped the garment, took a deep breath, and turned. Her supply of good Christian patience was awfully low, the way she'd missed most of John Evans's sermon, but being the kindly person she was, she said smoothly,
"Why, yes, Walter."
"So then, neighbor, had a bit of a goings-on the other night, eh?"
"I don't know what you're talking about."
"Billy had a load of something or other on the sack wagon."
"Oh, that. Yes, yes, that."
"What was that?"
"Oh, that. Well, yes, it was that."
"What was it?"
"Well, don't you know what a sack wagon's for?"
Oh, he hadn't meant to offend her. Of course, a sack wagon was for hauling sacks. He thought that's what it looked like. He smiled widely, and the squirrel around his head moved upward a few inches, making Emma shiver. It looked so real. He hung his florid face above the fence, like a red full moon, she thought grimly, and told her she had nothing to fear. He understood if she hauled things in her sack wagon that were not sacks. Then he giggled in the most obnoxious manner. Emma gave him a stare that surpassed the frigid morning air, and said if it was all right with him, she'd be pleased if he stayed to his own business, thank you. She went back inside with what she hoped was a courteous, regal walk. But Walter Trout saw the hat she was wearing backward, the hairpins hanging dangerously close to leaving her head altogether, then saw her near slip on the icy doorstep. A resounding laugh came from way down in his rotund belly as he shook his head from side to side, thinking of the delightful Emma Ferry. Hester was surprised to find Emma's angelic demeanor changed into one of red-faced fury when she finished the washing. Did she dislike that chore so thoroughly? Hester decided to offer to do the washing. She had always loved it, even in winter when her fingers became so cold she had to blow on them. Emma hung up the clothespin sack, clapped her hands a few times, then ladled hot water into a mug, added tea leaves, cut a large square of molasses cake, and chewed methodically. Hester sat by the fire in a worn rocking chair lined with coverlets. The bruise was not large, her dark eyes no longer slits in the purplish swelling, although she still faintly resembled a burst piece of fruit, in Billy's words. She watched Emma in silence. Suddenly, Emma burst out. "Some days I long for the farm. The idea of being townspeople may have appealed to me at one time, but this thing of hanging out my shifts for the nosy next-door neighbor to see just gricht mu gäse." It hurt Hester's head to laugh, but she had to, the body-shaking sound rolling out of her before she could stop it. "Oh, that felt good to laugh," she said breathlessly. "Kate used to say something got her goat." Emma Emma nodded, then reached for the pewter knife, measured another large square of the sweet brown cake, and plopped it happily on her plate.
Tell me about Kate. Tell me about Berks County. Have you ever been to Philadelphia?
Hester talked, slowly at first, then faster, as if she wanted Emma to see the woods and the stone house, Kate and the sweet babies that arrived so soon after they found her as a tiny newborn. She told her about Kate's dying, the ensuing misery when she was replaced by the hawkish Annie, how Noah and Isaac shunned her, and the reason she left, leaving her fate in God's hands. The reason she left, she said, was Annie's mistreatment of her. She never mentioned Hans. Why? It made her head hurt to think about Hans, for she still wrestled with self-blame. He had been good to her. He had provided a home, shelter, food, a way of life. It was Hans who showed her the discipline of the Amish, the way of the cross. Could she always blame her leaving on him alone? Some things were best left unsaid. The whole thing made her tired, made her head ache. Emma watched the battered Hester, gimlet-eyed, missing very little. Who was this girl? What was behind the sadness in her swollen black eyes? The good food Emma placed on the plank table nurtured Hester's body and spirit in the winter days after their talk. Billy came and went the way a ray of sunshine slips between puffy gray clouds, illuminating a room with its brilliance. His red hair waved and straggled about his head like copper-colored flames. His blue eyes shone with mischief, curiosity, and an appetite for life that only small boys possessed. He often wolfed down his evening meal, then roamed the streets of Lancaster Town, as he called it, claiming ownership to far more than he could in reality. He was the bearer of news, gossip, truth, and untruths. He soaked up tidbits like a dry sponge, then poured it forth at every evening meal, the only meal they ate together. Tonight, Emma had made chutzla, a quick filling dish that Hester had never tried. Emma had cut stale bread into cubes, toasted them in butter in a heavy skillet, then poured a mixture of beaten eggs and milk over top. She had also made Schmierkäse, from the whey stored in the cold cellar, a spreadable cheese Kate had sometimes made. Hester bent her head to her plate of nutritious food and ate every morsel. Emma watched her with satisfaction, noticing the color of her dark skin as the bruises healed. She could see Hester's unusual beauty emerge, the fine contour of her high cheekbones becoming more prominent.
Hey, Billy said.
Hester carefully spread the remaining cheese on a slice of bread before looking at Billy, who was energetically shoving a crust of bread along the rim of his plate, the way Hans had taught all the children at home.
They're saying?
He paused until Emma stopped chewing and gave him her full, undivided attention.
They're saying there's no Indian safe in the town of Lancaster. Nary a one.
Hester held very still, absorbing the words, fighting down the panic.
You know they got only 13 of them at the jailhouse. They're saying some men from Harrisburg want rid of them, just want to bushwhack them out of Pennsylvania entirely.
Hester nodded. She understood Nawate's words now. She could still feel the frosty air and see the sickle moon of that haunted evening. Yes, her people were leaving. Had left, or been killed. Well, they'd done plenty of killing themselves, the settlers' hearts quaking with terror as they heard tales of the marauding Indians on the western frontier. A heavy sadness followed these bits of news, darkening Hester's life like an angry black cloud that hid the sun's face whenever the threat was mentioned.
So you better not go out till this thing blows over, Billy finished, sticking a knife into a quivering custard pie before jerking the handle up and down like a saw. Now watch it there, Billy.
Emma looked up from her chutzla, her eyebrows lowered as he maneuvered the shaking pie onto his plate.
You have half of a pie there. The other half is for you.
Hester? Billy eyed her, then said she didn't eat pie like as not. Hester laughed, but the sound was hollow, a false tinkling sound like a distant cowbell that someone was shaking foolishly. Her thoughts churned, disturbing the normal flow of her mind, wondering, watching Billy's young face. If she was not safe here with Emma, would she ever be safe anywhere? Or safe, perhaps, but unwanted? A part of her wanted to rise from the table, gather a few belongings, and be on her way. But on her way to where? Back to Hans and Annie? The days stretched before her, dark and mysterious, swelling with gigantic questions, unanswered now. She had one thing, and that was her faith. God would protect her. Go with her. Hans had taught her this. The imperfect Hans. How could she believe a word he said after he betrayed her with his well-hidden ardor? Could she continue to believe in a God presented by Hans? Naote was true. He was faithful. He could press her head against his chest, and she could hear the steady beating of his heart, and nothing seemed wrong. If Hans would have tried the same gesture, it would have been vile, revolting. Should she have stayed and married Running Bear? Wenoma? A visual image of his face, slick with grease, was as real and as repulsive as ever. Emma Ferry finished her pie, sat back, and watched the display of emotions, fanned by her troubled thoughts. Well, if she had anything to say, this battered Indian girl would suffer no more if she could help it. And she fervently believed she could. A fierce, protective feeling welled in her chest. Hester had suffered enough. Emma's eyes narrowed shrewdly as her brain churned with possibilities. She'd have to let go of her pride and have a talk with that fat Walter Trout. She would find a way. Walter had just tucked into a delightful stack of buckwheat cakes soaked in butter and drizzled with maple syrup, a large white cloth stuck in his collar to protect his shirt, when there was a rapid knocking on his back door. Thinking how unusual that was, he became a bit hasty, heaving his oversized body from his kitchen chair so that he knocked over his coffee. Letting it go, he clucked mournfully at his loss, but hastened his bulk to the back door, pulling it open and waving an arm with a flourish when he saw who it was. Emma Ferry. She brushed past him, saying pointedly, "Take your bib off." He clawed at it hastily, the red of his face turning to an alarming shade of purple as he rolled the cloth between his fingers. Unsure if he should tell her it was not a bib but a cloth napkin which the gentry always had at their disposal. What would a German know about napkins? So he drew himself up to his full height of 5 feet and 5 inches and told Emma in clipped tones that it was not a bib but a napkin. She answered tartly that he could call it what he wanted, but it was still a bib. She walked into the kitchen ahead of him, eyed the stack of buckwheat cakes, and to her horror, her mouth began to water. She swallowed. She had never seen better-looking buckwheat cakes. She pulled at the ladder-back chair. Instantly, Walter rushed to her side, pulled the chair out, and asked her to be seated, but found he could not push the chair at all after she was on it. He observed the ample pile of skirts on each side of the chair and pretended not to notice when she bumped the chair up to the table herself.
"Now then, Emma Ferry, could I interest you in some buckwheat cakes?"
Emma swallowed. "My, from down here they looked even better."
"Perhaps you could,"
she said pointedly, feigning disinterest. But when he served her a stack of 3 cakes dripping with butter and a coating of syrup, made her a cup of tea, and handed her a cloth napkin, she didn't have the slightest idea what to do with it and laid the thing beside her plate. So that Emma wasn't as high up as she thought. But he enjoyed her obvious delight in the buckwheat cakes and didn't mind when she licked her fingers, then brought up a corner of her apron to wipe her mouth. Such rosy cheeks. So well-rounded, he thought. What a healing of his sad heart for her to grace his table. She asked the favor of him. Did he not own land outside the town, down by the Amish somewhere near Coatesville? Yes, he did. Was there a possibility that he could keep a secret then? Oh, yes, of course. His head was shining in the morning sunlight, the reflection bouncing off the mirror hung by his washbench, illuminating the skin to the highest sheen she had ever witnessed. The circle of gray hair looked thinner in the unforgiving light. Not entirely like a squirrel, she thought. Perhaps just part of one. "And on this land you own?" Emma said, pursing her lips and drawing out her question just enough to keep him on edge.
"Yes,"
he asked, eager to help Emma accomplish her goals.
"There is a dwelling?"
"Yes, oh, quite a presentable house, one built of log and bricks."
"And there is someone living there at present?"
"No, no. Jonas Fisher has inquired, but finds the rent too steep for his pocket."
"Well, then."
And Emma launched into a vivid account of Hester's arrival, keeping Walter mesmerized, for he had truthfully never expected the sack wagon to hold anything quite that frightful. At worst, he'd imagined Billy to have pilfered some hay, which he figured only served that Simon down at the tavern right. Emma wanted to move out there with Hester until these threats against the Redskins died out. Billy would go with them, of course, and she'd school him at home. It was unthinkable for Hester to stay indoors in the town for such an extended period of time. When spring arrived, she would need fresh air and sunshine. Oh, absolutely, Walter agreed over and over to Emma's plan, nodding his head so hard his chins wobbled and waggled as if they had entire lives of their own. Emma grabbed her own chin, tugged a few times before deciding, yes, definitely, she had only one. When he walked with her to the back door, he briefly rested his hand on her back, which made her stiffen and lower her voice a few degrees in iciness, but he paid her no heed. She was very German, and he had his napkins after all. Hester was seated at the kitchen table, a small pile of rye straw in front of her. Emma noticed the new look of concentration, a purposeful demeanor as she began the basket she would make.
"Wunderbar!"
Emma exclaimed, her spirits high, her cheeks flushed from the buckwheat cakes. Hester smiled. "I learned from Clover and Beaver. You wait." Emma clapped her hands like a small, overgrown child.
"So exciting! Hester, our house will be graced with your kaivolin."
"You say kaivolin for baskets too?"
she asked, her face alight with understanding. Emma sat across from Hester, explaining her visit to her neighbor, then told her she had nothing to fear, that she would be taken care of, not just this day or even this winter, but always. She told her she would be the daughter she never had. Walter was willing to let them stay at his house, where she could roam the woods and adjoining fields among the Amish, who would never harm her. They could raise a sow, have a flock of chickens and a cow. Hester's eyes glowed with happiness. She wiped her tears hurriedly and said she'd do her best to help make Emma's life easier. Emma was so touched by Hester's declaration of loyalty that she patted her shoulder with her soft, puffy fingers and said she must never fear about the future from this day forward. She, Emma Ferry, would look out for her, same as Billy would, for as long as she needed their protection. Over and over, she repeated herself, until Billy said he'd be the man of the house, but what was he going to do for excitement if they lived in the country? Without the tavern and the livery and his band of friends to roam the streets, life was going to be dull beyond anything he could imagine. Hester could easily explain the ways of the country. Water to haul, firewood to chop, animals to feed, garden to tend, the list went on and on. Billy listened, his eyebrows drawn down as he thought about Hester's words.
"Well, I know, but if you do all that work, there's not a whole lot left for me to do."
Emma told him he needed his ears boxed. Hester was happy to move to the country. She hoped her gardening skills were sufficient, as well as being able to keep house the way Emma required. The German Emma was always scouring floors, washing, and carefully smoothing out clothes and bedsheets, even linen towels and doilies, as if one speck of dirt would never be allowed to exist on anything washable. Hester wove the rye straw expertly, drawing the rows tightly with strips of willow bark, a basket style whose origin was half German and half Indian. Emma was amazed. Billy fell silent, his bright eyes watching Hester's fingers like an observant hawk. Hester began to talk of her time with the Indians, about Nahuatl, Running Bear, Clover, and Beaver, the ways of the longhouse, their weapons and primitive tools. She spoke of her inability to stay, sometimes still not understanding the choice she had made. Billy snorted.
Seems you didn't have much choice there toward the last.
Hester laughed easily, her eyes shining dark pools of appreciation. No, I didn't.
You were sort of dumped into the feedlot by the livery, and if I remember right, I found you dead as a doornail.
Emma broke in.
Now, Billy, she was alive. Barely.
Hester nodded, her face serious. I would have died.
Billy told her if those men found her, he knew she'd be better off dead.
When a pounding on the front door exploded the homey atmosphere of the kitchen, they jumped, sat erect, then looked at one another with questions in their eyes, all fearfully recognizing that Hester might not be safe. Emma was the first to think rationally. For someone of her size, she moved with lightning speed, opening the cellar door and beckoning Hester.
Into the potato bin. Cover yourself.
Hester knew she must obey. She asked no questions, merely slipped down the narrow, steep stairs backward, holding onto the railing on each side until her feet found the uneven earthen floor. It was pitch black, but her hands fluttered in front of her until they found the stone walls, the shelves, the meat hanging on hooks. She stifled a cry as a large rodent scuttled across her woolen sock-clad feet. Chapter 8. Light, quick footsteps moved out of the kitchen and down the hallway. There was the creak of the front door. Voices. Hester moved blindly, her hands roaming the walls of the cellar. Heavy footsteps. The solid clunking of big boots thundering down on the oak floor like an avalanche of boulders. Emma's voice. Hester moved faster, her hands raking the wall. Where was the potato bin? It had to be here somewhere. She heard the rough voices of men. She heard Emma say they could look all they wanted. She had seen no Indian running away. She heard the steps of the men going upstairs. For one heart-stopping instant, she believed they were lowering themselves into the cellar. If they found her here, she had no way of escape. The steps were muted, far away now. Hester imagined them upstairs. Enormous dark bodies, massive white faces outlined with black beards and filthy, smelly hats of fur and leather, glittering, greedy eyes, their single-minded goal to rid the town of Lancaster of the last of the Redskins, the Conestogas. Hester thought of the jailhouse, the hunger and filth she heard of there, where she would be taken to join the small band of surviving Conestogas. When she heard the muted steps returning down the stairs, she moved frantically, the potato bin seeming completely unreachable. Surely it was along a wall. Perhaps not. She began swinging her arms wide, searching, when one hand slapped against rough lumber. Thank God. With both hands, she found the square box. Bending over, she felt a large mound of potatoes. More loud footsteps sounded overhead. Her mind rushed faster. She had no time to cover herself with the small vegetables. It would take too long. Could she squeeze beneath the bin? She measured with her hands. Emma was talking, her words following a calm, relaxed march of ordinary words as she acted the part of a round little housewife, a Dummkopf, asking silly questions about the Indians that had nothing to do with this night or this mission. Hester found enough space, she thought. Lowering herself, she flattened her body, wriggling and clawing with her hands. She felt the unhealed bruises on her head being squeezed. Dust and dirt slid past her cheek and filled her nose and mouth. Inch by inch, she pushed into the narrow crevice beneath the wooden bin containing the summer's potatoes. The voices overhead continued. Hester could not understand the words. She could go no farther. The floor rose in a mound beneath the potato bin. With every ounce of her strength, she pulled her hips and knees further into the opening. She stopped, guessing her skirt was hidden away. She had to leave the rest of her fate to God. If they came down the cellar steps and found her, then her life would surely be over. It was hard to think of dying, but harder yet to imagine the hunger and torture of jail. As she thought of her life being in the hands of these swarthy, uncouth men, she inched her way into the crevice a bit more. The dry, rasping sound of a snake. She stifled a cry as its heavy body slithered across her hand, then down across her knees. The cellar door opened. A rectangle of flickering yellow light shone directly ahead of her. The men lost no time, coming down the steep stairway backward the way she had come. Hester heard the scurrying of the rodents. She realized she had squeezed beneath the potato bin from the wall side, away from where the men had planted their feet. Had she come from the front, where there was no opening beneath it, she'd have never found her hiding place. She felt a cough begin in her throat. The veins in her neck swelled, her eyes squeezed shut, her mouth worked as she tried to abort the raucous sound that ached to be released. "I will not cough. I will not cough." She swallowed over and over, finding with each contraction of her neck muscles that the sensation was receding. Loud voices. Footsteps on the packed earthen floor.
"There ain't no engine down here." "Snake!"
A bawling sound, a howl of mocking laughter, and another one of glee as a man ran straight up the stairs. She heard Emma.
"I told you there ain't nothing down them steps."
"Potatoes."
"Yeah, fool. I work hard to dig them katufla. You let them be."
Hester heard voices.
"You hear?"
Emma shouted. When there was no answer, Emma warned them once more, her tone strident but relaxed. After all, she was only an ordinary housewife, protecting a summer's bounty, an important staple for the winter. A rude reply rasped directly in front of Hester. She shivered and felt tears of panic begin to form. Now they were reaching into the bin, the candle held aloft, rolling the potatoes and laughing. They compared sizes, filling their empty pockets with the vegetables. The men were so close she could hear their breathing. She smelled horses, stale sweat, deerskin, leather, tobacco. Hester's throat worked as she swallowed her fear. Emma shouted down the opening of the stairway.
"You leave them katufla be. You let them down there for me and Billy. I'll tell the constable about you making off with my stuff. You hear me?"
There was only a rude, mocking sound in reply. That and a boot kicking the corner of the bin. A fine layer of dust from the potatoes filtered down on Hester's face. It felt cool, smelled like Annie's garden. Before she could think, a sneeze tore through her nose. She pushed her tongue against the roof of her mouth and willed the rush of air to be compressed. A sound squeezed out, but it was overridden by another clattering of heavy boots on the stairway. Breathing rapidly, her nostrils filled with dirt, Hester lay beneath the potatoes and thanked her Heavenly Father for keeping her safe. The image of John Lance, the Amish bishop, his hair white, his blue eyes piercing, saying, "Gott sie gelobt und gedankt," filled her mind. She repeated the saying over and over, the treasure of the word's meaning increasing fourfold now. The choking dirt that filtered over her face took her back to the dust and heat of August. As she bent over a row of beans or hoed newly planted beets, she could see the flight of the butterflies above the purple blossoms, erratic little upward flutterings, only to zigzag sideways or plummet ungracefully to hover over blossoms before moving dizzily on their way. Butterflies were beautiful creatures, but without smooth flight patterns, which birds and other airborne insects had. She could hear the clatter of the ironclad wooden wheels of the wagon bouncing over the rutted field lane. Hans was driving the faithful plodding team, while Noah sprawled on top of the hay, his hair as light as the hot white sunshine, Isaac beside him, a darker shadow. When Kate was alive, they would have waved, called out a silly saying. Hester would have straightened her back, waved and answered, a smile playing around her perfect mouth, her spirits lifted. When Annie became their mother, she spread her venomous jealousy to Hester's brothers, her staunchest friends, and they no longer acknowledged her presence in the garden or the barn at milking time. Nowhere ever. Hester carried that great and awful pain like a growth close to her heart that cut off her capacity to feel joy. Her brother's love had carried her through the rough spots that occurred in her life, her grafting into the Amish community softened by their protection. Lying beneath the bin of potatoes in Emma Ferry's house in this strange Lancaster town, Hester wondered at the twists and turns in the uncertain path of her life so far. Maybe sometime she'd be able to go back to Berks County, back to her childhood home where butterflies flitted blue and orange and black and yellow, and the dust was filled with the scent of honeysuckle and wonder. Hester longed for that lost sweetness, savoring the sights and smells of that time when she had been filled with belonging, the serenity that came from knowing her place in the world. All this flashed through her mind as Emma's staccato voice berated the men who had searched her house. She told them God would hold them accountable for stuffing their pockets with a poor widow's potatoes. She hoped their horses would all get hoof rot and their wagon wheels would fall off. She banged the door after them, then sagged against it. The color drained out of her face and a sheen of sweat appeared on her forehead as she yelled at Billy to bring the smelling salts. She was sure her heart was not going to take this. She moaned about poor, poor Hester down in that cellar. Oh, what had she gone through? Tears puddled and dripped from her doughy cheeks as she rained down other wishes of deep trouble on those stinkish Amena. For what she felt responsibility for, she fiercely loved and protected and passionately esteemed as her own, sometimes to the point that Billy wished she'd stop saying all those flowery speeches. A fella didn't need to hear all that. But his eyes shone with the goodness of Emma's love and spread right out of his own heart to others, without him even realizing it. The next day, all the Indians that were held in the county jail were murdered. 14 of them were hacked to death by a group of men that called themselves the Paxton Boys, led by a minister who was a zealot. The town of Lancaster and the area around it had effectively been freed of any Indians they believed. Hester heard the news, but her face showed no evidence of distress. She just folded in like a withering plant and did not speak the remainder of the evening. Emma watched Hester closely, but decided to leave her alone to mourn, to sort out her feelings, to absorb this terrible deed done against her people. For weeks, Billy arrived, breathless with one gruesome story or another. Hester gave no sign that she heard one word, simply bowing her head to her basket weaving without a single tear or acknowledgement of his presence. Emma and Billy discussed the moving. It would be odd to move their belongings in the dead of winter. People would talk. They stoked the fires, cleaned the house, cooked their meals, always watchful as they went about their usual routines. Every Sunday morning, Emma dressed in her Lord's Day finery, combed Billy's rebellious mop of hair, pinned his high collar amid furious grimaces as she worked. Then they set off for First Reformed Church on Orange Street. Hester had to stay behind for safety's sake. Emma was well aware that other Indians were still in the area, some of them hired out as slaves, serving wealthy families without wages, but she took no chances. Helen Dienlinger told her there was talk of an Indian girl having escaped the jail the night of the massacre, and that she was living with Emma Ferry. Then Helen looked at her with two bright eyes and a knowing smile. Emma waved a hand, dismissing her entirely, then turned to speak to her neighbor, Walter Trout, who became so gratified by the widow Emma's attention that he began to stutter, something he hadn't done since he was 8 or 9 years old. Hester sat by the crackling fire, enjoying its warmth, then got up to look out the many paned windows, watching the carriages and wagons moving up and down Mulberry Street. In winter, most folks were hidden inside their carriages, but frequently an open wagon would rumble by, the wagon's inhabitants blobs beneath layers of buffalo robes and even their faces obscured. Pedestrians walked off to the sides of the streets through the snow, ladies lifting their skirts daintily as carriages rattled by. All going to church, Hester thought. She had never seen the huge brick church houses Emma described, or the stone ones. Everyone went to church. There were so many different ones, it was dizzying. Why, if they all believed in the same God and his son Jesus, were there so many different ways to worship? It was more than Hester could figure out, so she stood hidden by Emma's spotless white curtains and observed the people. Always, she stayed alert, her senses tuned for any peace-crushing blow delivered to the sturdy oak door that led to the street. Hester turned away from the window and sighed restlessly. Going to the small mirror above the hall table, she examined the wounds on her face in the light from the snow and sun. She found a redness, but very little besides. That pleased her immensely. She wandered back to the window and saw a tall, top-hatted man walking sedately, a lady's hand on his arm, her skirts spread below her coat like a yellow flower. What unthinkable finery! So out of the Amish Ordnung, the stringent rules that kept them obedient, that held them within the promise they had made to be faithful. Hester had always been accustomed to wearing a huge cap and hat pulled well past her face with a heavy black woolen shawl pinned severely over her shoulders. If she wore her Amish outerwear, she would not be taken for an Indian. But the Amish did not live in town, so that would be stranger still. An oddity yet. An oddity all her life. Well, she wouldn't look too far ahead, which was like welcoming a whole nest of wasps into a kitchen. It did no good, brought a load of unnecessary anxiety, and in the end, a stinging pain that had to be daubed with care, same as memories that were painfully colorful. She looked forward to spring, the time when they would take their belongings and move to the country, close to the Amish. Today was the Sabbath, so she would not work at her baskets. But she felt restless, a longing for something she couldn't name. If she had wings like an eagle, she'd fly above this house and all the others that looked exactly the same. In row upon row of wooden houses with brick chimneys rising from their middles, gray smoke waved endlessly, coming from the heating and cooking fire in the shuba, the soul of each house. Hester sighed again. She sat down, reaching for the Heilische Schrift, the great German Bible Emma delved into constantly, reading out loud to Billy, who, like as not, was fast asleep or carving a small object from a stick of wood. Hester looked at the intricate black and white pictures and tried to read in Mathoi, but so many of the words eluded her. Reading in English was difficult enough. Reading German was like climbing a tree without branches. Hans had taught all his children well. He brought out the catechism every Sunday morning as regularly as he milked cows. Noah and Isaac were brilliant. Hester could read only haltingly, but Hans had praised her nevertheless, his eyes warm and brown, staying on her face too long. She could never remember hearing him give a word of encouragement to Noah or Isaac, and they so deserved it. In one quick, fluid movement, Hester rose, a fierceness in her change of position. Taking the German Bible in both hands, she dropped it on the floor solidly. Her breathing came hard. Noah and Isaac had been slaves, toiling from the time the sun appeared above the mountain till it sank below the opposite one. And always, always, she had received flowery words of gratitude for the smallest endeavor. Well, she'd gotten what she deserved, she supposed. Reaped richly the suffocating jealousy of her stepmother after, like a slow-witted opossum that's so easily trapped, she finally saw Hans for what he was. For a moment she was tempted to compare herself to Joseph in the Old Testament, who had been persecuted because of jealousy. But he was good and holy and found favor in God's eyes. She too had a coat of many colors laid on her shoulders, in the form of colored linen made into her Sunday dresses. And when other little girls had one Sunday dress, she had three. Ah, but he had loved her, she tried to convince herself, in the proper way a father loves a daughter. It was she who had done wrong, perhaps, but how? She paced the confines of the house, accusing herself. But for what? Her past was like rain, life-giving, sweet and generous in its abundance of things that were good. But if she lingered too long in this rain, she became cold and uncomfortable and needed to retreat to a place where the rain could not touch her. And yet, it still did. The rain penetrated her heart, filling it with sadness for Noah and for Isaac. They were such noble young brothers, working endlessly to Hans's and Annie's specifications until they built the farm from a lowly log house and a few cleared acres to the status of a homestead belonging to Hans and Annie Suk. They were regarded as the best managers in Berks County, owners of a large stone house and barn and of the finest herd of cows in that area, if not in all of Pennsylvania, plus a couple of Belgian horses and a blacksmithy. Hans had it all. Hester's eyes narrowed. Yes, he did. But by his shrewd wife's manipulation, and the sweat of Noah's and Isaac's brows. Perhaps it was better that she wasn't alone too much, the way these thoughts rushed around in her mind, creating ripples of pain. Why did she remember her brothers so keenly now? If only she could talk to them and make things right. She wanted to tell them that they were the ones who deserved to be exalted, lifted up, encouraged. Just look at me. Please look at me. Talk to me. I need to tell you these things. Hester was relieved when a quiet rapping sounded on the door. She quickly scooped up the Bible she had let fall, then hurried to slide back the bolt on the door, allowing Emma and Billy to enter. Emma's face was flushed, two purplish spots appearing on either cheek. Her nose looked bruised from the cold, and her green hat was sliding to the back of her head. She resembled a frenzied bantam hen at home in the barnyard when a skunk raided her small, neat nest of eggs.
"We're getting company," she said. "Rufus and Helen Dienlinger and Walter Trout," Billy crowed, already divesting himself of the noose other people called a collar.
But Hester was bewildered. Emma was sliding the wool cape off her rounded shoulders, her eyes flashing beneath the folds of skin, now heightened to an alarming pink color.
"Now, Hester, you don't worry. If Helen is nosy, then she's going to have the surprise of her life. You are my new maid from Virginia, a slave. Here."
She stopped Hester, handed her a ruffled housewife's cap and an apron that was so oversized it was ridiculous. But since Emma didn't seem to mind, Hester didn't either. Emma fried salt pork, the pan so sizzling hot it was only a miracle the kitchen didn't go up in flames. She peeled potatoes while Hester laid the table with a plain white tablecloth, serviceable ironstone plates, pewter utensils, and clay tumblers. They served the sauerkraut with dumplings, the salt pork with pickled watermelon rind. The potatoes had a whole lake of brown butter on the mounded top. Like a volcano, the butter spilled down the sides, pooling around the edges of the serving bowl. Emma served the chilled chow chow in a glass dish. Pats of homemade butter gleamed and shone by the tall candles. Thickened elderberries sat alongside the butter, making a perfect marriage of fat and sweet to spread on thick chunks of crusty German bread. Helen Dienlinger was a bit stout, although she girded herself so severely that she appeared slender, at least in the proper places. As she ate and ate and ate, her face grew steadily more colorful, her eyes decreased in size, and her breathing became decidedly more labored, like a plodding horse pulling a plow in the spring. She mentioned the delightful way the Germans served their bread in a thin, gasping voice before reaching for another thick, crusty chunk, spreading it with a greedy portion of butter and the marvelous berries. Her husband ate like a starving wolf, lowering his head and shoveling it in without the good manners of taking time to answer the smallest inquiry. Walter Trout sat at the end of the table where there was plenty of room, cut his salt pork with knife and fork, poised like a perfect British gentleman, slowly chewing the neat squares of meat with his mouth closed. His small mouth moving up and down in a grinding circular motion completely entranced Billy, who thought it amazing the way that small opening could be the only door for so much food. To his knowledge, Walter had never tasted German cooking. He found the dumplings on the sauerkraut blissful, the salt pork heavenly, the turnips absolutely divine. Billy rolled his eyes at Hester.
"I can tell you come fresh off a sermon," he quipped.
Emma was so mortified she didn't know what to do.
But when she looked at Walter, and he was rolling from side to side, trying to repress his good-humored mirth, she spluttered, then gave up and lifted her hands, howling with unladylike glee that Helen Dienlinger found ill-mannered. And since she had to struggle to breathe, she certainly could not waste precious air in laughing. That Billy Fairy needed to learn manners, to be seen and not heard. Hester hovered over the Sunday dinner, the ruffled